Wednesday, August 29th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry.
Hi, Amy.
On our program this week, is Google rigging search results that consistently paint the president in a negative light? He thinks so. And he's instructed his advisors to look into possible regulation of the tech giant's search algorithm. A couple of newspapers in the McClatchy Group are trying out a new online subscription model, sports only. The Kansas City Star is one of the first papers to try it out. Novel idea. I'll ask Mike and Ernest what they think. And after 12 years on CBS, the longest running multi-camera series prepares its final season. Will it go out with a big bang? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to in this half hour, but let's start with Saturday's passing of Arizona Senator John McCain. Here we are on Wednesday, as he's lying in state in Arizona, and the tributes are still pouring in just as effusively as they were Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, he is a politician who was right for the moment. He's somebody who's also been around for a long time and represented things that people, you know, resonate with. He was a war hero. He was, you know, captured, and he has been a maverick. He's spoken out against his own party when it made sense to him anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are lots of reasons why he should receive attention, but we shouldn't also forget that he had a pretty special relationship with the national media, which might explain sort of the almost over-the-top, you know, coverage of him the past few days.
I mean, I think it does. He was one of the, I mean, I guess if you can say he's one of the stalwarts of the Senate, and the old school Senate, I guess you would say, where there was a cooperative kind of relationship between politicians and the media. And he wasn't adversarial when it came to dealing with them, whether you're talking about his role in the Senate or his role as a presidential candidate twice. He was very open to having those conversations. And even when he disagreed with the way in which the coverage was, if it was fair, he would let a reporter know that.
There was one anecdote I had heard this weekend that, and I wish I could remember who the reporter was who said it, but he was up on the Hill, asked a question of Senator McCain, and Senator McCain looked at him afterwards, gave him some kind of an answer, but looked at him afterwards and said, "That was a really stupid question," and kind of gave it to him a little bit. And the next time this reporter asked him a question, McCain started with, "You know what? That's not a stupid question." But he had that give and take, yeah, too.
He did, and it's interesting because there were times that he would be very prickly with the media, just as he was prickly with other folks, but he was accessible. You know, journalists like the fact that he always made himself accessible.
Held the record for the number of appearances on NBC's Meet the Press.
He did, and he spoke plainly. And journalists like it when you don't talk in bureaucraties or government speak. It makes for better sound bites and makes for better stories. But I have to say, I mean, I watched the coverage this weekend, and I think he's a man who deserves some of the coverage he received. But if you watch, say, CNN, I mean, you had reporters who were openly thanking him for teaching them how to do their job better. You actually had on Sunday, when the Jacksonville shooting occurred at that gaming tournament, where CNN, for example, was spending its time on McCain and would just cut away occasionally to the shooting, not something they normally would do. So it kind of makes me wonder a little bit if part of the coverage was also a reaction to President Trump, because McCain was a huge foil for the president.
I was going to say, because of kind of their battles between each other.
I think it was that, but I also think it was also journalists probably going, you know, this is the kind of person that I miss talking to. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of government official that I would love to go back to have. You know, if we could go back to this kind
of
a relationship.
The good old days of political
coverage. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really was a lot of this. Like, okay, here's another politician that we've lost, who had a relationship with the media that allowed us to be able to do our jobs of telling what was going on in Washington back to the people who are actually doing the voting and making the everyday decisions, at least in their lives, and making that connection between what government does and whether or not it has an impact on people. And that's missing right now, because a lot of the political coverage, as we talk about every week, mm-hmm, a lot of it is adversarial, and it doesn't really get to people where they live.
I don't know to what extent that's journalists looking back with rose-colored glasses versus it really having been this way before. But if we think it's going to go back, revert back to that kind of open give and take anytime soon, I doubt it.
I doubt it.
Well, so last week we were talking about that day last Tuesday that no one was expecting, the simultaneous Manafort conviction and Cohen plea. Well, we've learned a lot more about how the feds got Cohen to turn, including giving immunity to National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. There were some fascinating little nuggets that came out about this, especially how the catch and kill strategy with some of these stories, the idea that there were stories that he not only caught and killed, but he put in a safe.
Yeah, I mean, the stories are strange, but I when I go back and I look at it, I go like, this, in some ways, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, you have people at this higher level who can do this, who can basically decide whether or not a story is going to make, whether or not you can actually stop a story from getting into a tabloid. I mean, the tabloids are all about putting out stories that really drawing readers.
And the more outrageous, the better.
Absolutely. And think about some of the outrageous stories that they were able to that Pecker was basically able to say, no, we're not going to go with that because I have a relationship or I'm getting money from, or somewhere down the line I can call in a favor on, you know, those kinds of things. So that's what really intrigued me about a lot of this.
I'm also intrigued by just looking at the potential liabilities for the president because of the people who were his closest friends and advisors. You know, Pecker and Cohen and others, they kept documentation in safes. They recorded phone conversations. When those are the people you're looking out to be loyal to you, you better hope that you don't put them in a situation where they feel like they have to turn tail, because now they've got potentially the goods that the prosecutor, the special counsel, could use to really hurt the president.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I was listening to some pundits talk about this over the weekend, and one of them actually said, you know, in the whole grand scheme of things, why is anyone surprised?
Mm-hmm.
Because,
well,
you've
been saying that for
a
year, too.
I know.
Why are you surprised?
And, his, you know, the president's approval ratings are staying pretty much the same. And the pundit, the one pundit I was listening to, made this point. He said, look, those who voted for him knew what they were getting. They knew all of this. It doesn't bother them. And unless the special prosecutor, unless Robert Mueller comes out with some serious charges of conspiracy and high crimes and misdemeanors, then, you know, it's just going to be one story after another.
Which makes me wonder if there wasn't one other person granted immunity this weekend who might even have more information that could be damaging to President Trump than the folks we've already mentioned. And that's Alan Weisselberg, who's the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization back when Daddy was running the company. So he knows about a lot of things. And if what we're hearing reported is true, he may have facilitated some of these illegal campaign payments. And so that there's somebody who's got a lot of information. We don't know what level of immunity he was granted. It wasn't like global immunity, but that could be important.
Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, this keeps going too. You talk about, you know, who knows what and when and where that information's coming from. News that comes out yesterday, too, that a CNN scoop that dated back to July is potentially not so accurate, now that we're beginning to find out who some of the anonymous sources were in that reporting.
Yeah, this is really disturbing, and I hope that CNN will address it in ways that it hasn't so far. But the initial story was basically that Michael Cohen was in the room when President Trump found out about the meetings with the Russians at Trump Tower, when he had claimed he hadn't found out about it until later. Now, the source for that story, at least one of the sources for that story for CNN and the Washington Post and the New York Post, was Lanny Davis, the attorney for Cohen. And then he said, well, no, I don't really can't say that that happened, that the president knew in advance. The Washington Post and the New York Post retracted their story. CNN said, no, we stand by our story. And the story said that they had sources, plural, who claimed to know that the president had advance knowledge. You know, CNN probably needs to say a little bit more than it has so far.
I think so, because now you run into that issue of, you know, and this is the whole, you know, granting anonymity, mm-hmm. which we've talked about over and over, and how that creates problems in terms of credibility. So as this investigation continues, you run, at least CNN runs the risk of people not believing the stories they're telling, because, you know, they seem to be wallowing in this, you know, we're going to grant anonymity to anyone and everyone who can, at least this is the perception that people have, anyone in, that has some sort of connection to what's going on in either in the Trump White House or the Trump campaign back during when this whole Russia incident began.
And CNN even had Anderson Cooper had Lanny Davis on denying he was the source,
right,
when he'd already been outed as the source.
But then they went back to the whole thing about, you know, well, but we have other sources. Well, okay, if you have other sources, then where are they? Because right now your credibility is in question.
Okay, so while we're talking about credibility, the president creating foreign policy via Twitter, it isn't necessarily news. What is? When those tweets are based on information that's not entirely based in truth. Like this clip from Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News about the South African government seizing land from white farmers in that country.
State Department did not mention that by following the rule of law, he has changed the country's constitution to make it possible to steal land from people because they are the wrong skin color. In other words, nothing to see here, says Mike Pompeo's State Department. It's totally okay for South Africa to steal property for racist reasons because they are, quote, a strong democracy and held, quote, public hearings. Criminals take note, find a buddy, start robbing State Department employees on their way to work. By their logic, as long as you outnumber them, they'll be okay with getting robbed because it's democracy.
So that clip in its entirety, you can see parts of it on our links blog. It ran about 9.5 minutes, and the president saw that broadcast, which really lacked significant context into the history of farm seizures, which lacked the very important fact that these are still proposed seizures, that the government hasn't taken any property yet, and that there's actually work in South Africa going into making a constitutional amendment, and that's currently in progress. But the president saw the broadcast and he went to Twitter to announce that he was going to instruct Secretary Pompeo to study the land and farm seizures and the expropriations and the large-scale killing of farmers. That escalated quickly. You want to talk about fake news? That's fake news.
That's some serious fake news. Let's not even go into the fact that it was originally the white farmers who stole it from the blacks when they colonized South Africa under apartheid.
Yeah.
So we're not even getting into that. You know, this goes way past fake news into revisionist history is where this is going. I mean, and Tucker Carlson, this doesn't surprise me. I mean, this just sort of falls in the line with basically what you've seen even going prior to Trump, which is anything that can sow any dissent between the races, Fox News is going to jump on it, and they're generally on the side of, well, hey, you know, here we go with, you know, whites being treated differently or being considered the minority as opposed to the majority.
And there are frankly going to be fewer societies or countries in which there has been a greater injustice than South Africa.
Right, right. I mean, even the South Africans were going like, whoa, wait, even the white South Africans were going like, whoa.
Slow your roll, dude.
Wait a minute.
You guys are coming from on this.
You guys are totally wrong on this. Stay out of it.
Okay, Mike, you're jumping over there.
Everything that you just said, of course, is accurate. The other things I would add to it are, well, one, you identified one of the problems, Amy, and that's that the president seems to be making foreign policy pronouncements based on watching one story on one show on Fox News.
On one night.
That's a problem. But the other problem may be that the president is willing to do this to suggest we need to make a change in foreign policy, not because he's researched it or even because he believes it's a problem, but because it will divert our attention from other things that he doesn't want us to be thinking about.
No, I think you're absolutely. I mean, this goes back to what we talk about all the time is, you know, the squirrel effect, you mm-hmm. know, that we seem to have.
Look, there's a nut.
Yeah,
there's,
yeah. every time, you know, we see a tweet that pops up. And it's almost like I'm starting to think that there is a coordinated effort between the president and his people, Fox News, be it Hannity, be it Carlson Tucker, be it Laura Ingraham, be it just go down the list and say, okay, we need a diversion. So
what you got?
You know,
this isn't funny. We shouldn't be laughing. But it's so absurd. We can't help but laugh at it in some ways.
And what bothers me about all this is that it works.
It does.
The rest of the national media immediately falls for it, and they go after that. And the bigger picture is lost.
Okay, so here's our next example. Not only is the president responding and creating policy based on what he sees on TV, yesterday he came out against Google, saying that the search engine's algorithms are rigged, ranking reporting from publications he considers to be fake news over the more Trump-friendly stories. Google, as you can imagine, denies this, but that's not enough for the president. He wants to look into regulating Google and other search engines and the way they program their algorithms. Reporters asked economic advisor Larry Kudlow to explain what exactly that might mean.
Clarify that statement you made on Google when you said you're taking a look into it. Mm-hmm. I know that's a sensitive subject. Could you explain a little bit what you're looking into, what you'd like to see happen there?
No. Okay. We're just looking into it.
Okay, just looking into it. Yeah. Just leave it at that.
I said,
thank you. What are you looking into specifically?
We're just doing some investigation and some analysis. That's what we do.
Is there any evidence that they actually are censoring anyone's search results?
We're looking into it.
They're looking into it. And Ernest is sitting here laughing at me. In all seriousness, though, Google has literally since day one been secretive about how these algorithms work and how they rank pages, not just news sources, but pages in general, to prevent exactly what it is that the president claims is happening here.
I tend to believe Google saying that the algorithms are not rigged, at least in the definition of that word. Mm-hmm. Now, they do things like, we're told, measure how long a publication has been out there, what its reputation is, measured somehow, I don't know how, by how well they tag their stories. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that could lead to mainstream news organizations popping up
when you search on Trump news. Inbound links, outbound links. Number of times people click on some of those things.
So all of those things could lead, if you want to believe it, that news outlets who are by definition going to be covering the controversies of the day involving Trump are doing more negative news about him. The thing that concerns me, though, is that now we've got these hearings coming up, and I think it's the Senate committee next week. Mm-hmm. So you've got Facebook, Twitter, and Google officials coming in to testify, and they're going to be raked over the coals for this alleged, attempt to hide conservative content. And there's no question that the people, and then the leaders especially of those three companies, tend to have more of a liberal political persuasion. Jack Dorsey from Twitter basically said, yeah, that's true of our company, but we don't let it affect our results. Mm-hmm. You had a controversy at Facebook just this week that popped up where one of their employees complained that employees who espouse conservative beliefs get raked over the coals, get threatened with firing. And so those add to the narrative that the president, I think, falsely is putting out there, mm-hmm. that the actual results themselves are biased.
Yeah, I read this story on this when it first came out. I'm looking in, and then looking at the clip that's on our, Link's blog, where I said, we're going to look into it. Okay.
What are you looking into?
I'm like, good luck with that. How are you going to do that? You're going to have these hearings. And Mike, you're right. Everything that you just said in terms of these officials going, it's going to be the classic, especially if it's a House committee. I mean, you're going to have the classic conservative, right wing going after Google. And then you're going to have them trying to defend what they do. It's going to last for about a 24-hour news cycle, and then we're going to be back on something else. I mean, this is another classic,
squirrel and nut.
Yeah, squirrel and nut thing. It's like, okay, I'm upset at Google right now, but, who knows? I may like them. They may be very good people come next week. I don't know.
Ernest, you're making me laugh. I'm sorry. So on the cable networks, they have already started the countdown clocks. We are 68 days away from the midterm election. 68 days. And While most news organizations are deploying resources to cover the horse race that is so many of these campaigns, others are looking for ways to cover civic involvement and working to get the vote out. ProPublica is one of these, starting an online effort to really encourage first-time voters and have them understand the important role they could play.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a straightforward enough thing. Let's show you where your polling places are, how to register to vote, who are the candidates in your house, you know, race. That's all pretty straightforward stuff, and it seems to me that it falls in line with the job of journalists to inform the public. For what purpose? So that they can be better citizens, they can engage in public life. So I don't see a problem with that as far as it goes, as long as these news organizations are not trying to convince me through their news stories that I should vote a particular way.
No, I'm with you. I mean, I think this is the kind of public service journalism that we don't talk enough about. And I think it is important. You're right, Mike, that, you know, as long as they don't go into the realm of, you know, trying to influence people to vote a certain way, but just work with them on how can I get out and vote? Where can I go? Where's my polling place? Those kinds of things. And really talk about the issues that people should really care about and not necessarily what's going on.
You mean the stuff that we have spent the last 20
absolutely,
minutes talking
absolutely,
about?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we'll talk about some other things then. Readers of the New York Times' website might have noticed a redesign in the last few days. It's subtle. The navigation is the same and the font is as well. It's a little bit boxier in the display. Some of the things that are missing from what you might have seen before, the red timestamps on new and updated stories and reporter bylines under the headlines of news stories. One of the things we've been talking about a lot lately is that reporters need to make it less about them. But one of the things I really liked and already miss about this redesign from what the New York Times had been was having those bylines, because I'd see the story and I'd see Maggie Haberman's name or Michael Grinbaum's name, and I'd say, you know what? I trust them. I'm going to read this story. I can believe what's in it.
I guess I can see it either way. For me, though, I've been a longtime reader of the New York Times. I already trust the institution because mm-hmm. of those journalists. But I don't really care about the bylines, except whenever I'm looking for an opinion columnist. And frankly, the website, which I use maybe 5% of the time, now looks a whole lot like mobile, which is what I always use to consume the New York Times. And when I'm doing that, I'm not really looking for bylines.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with Mike.
Right.
You know.
I own it. I'm the odd one out on this one.
On the news stories, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the bylines. I do pay attention on the opinion writers. The thing that I miss is I do miss that timestamp, because the red one, because that would tell me, okay, this story is updated. If I immediately look at that and see that, okay, they just updated the story, there may be some new information, I'll go in and I'll see, okay, what is the new information, and then I'll move on. That was helpful, and I kind of wish they would bring that back.
From a producer's standpoint, and somebody who did run a news homepage for so many years, in my eyes, that element of the design is what brings the urgency to the reader. Mm-hmm. That's what tells us, here's what's new. Mm-hmm. Here's what's urgent. Here's what you really... And the red is what says, look at this now.
Yeah.
But wouldn't you also say that the purpose of the homepage has changed, because most people don't get to the content of your site through the homepage?
Right.
Anymore.
I'm also a dinosaur in that regard. I am still a homepage visitor.
I mean, I still do it too when I'm at my desk and I'm trying to just keep up with something. Mm-hmm. But I'm with Mike. Most of the time, it's either on my tablet or it's on my cell phone. I'm looking through it. And like I said, that red timestamp does sort of catch my eye when I'm pulling something.
And get back to bylines for just a second. When you go into the individual stories,
Okay, so Marshall Field, he used to say, give the lady what she wants. Maybe McClatchy is taking a page out of that playbook with its new subscription model, now being tested at the Kansas City Star and Miami Herald. For $30 a year, $2.50 a month, subscribers get unrestricted access to all of the paper's sports coverage. So again, Miami is trying this in two markets, one regionally close to us that have a very strong professional and college sports presence. You talk about Kansas City, you have the Chiefs, you have MU, you have KU, you have the Royals, you have Sporting KC. They're really seeing sports as kind of the cornerstone of the draw and marketing that to audiences.
And it is. It is. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that's long overdue that I thought that newspapers should have been doing back in the early days of the internet and of the web, you can monetize that because especially when you're talking about local sports, because ESPN in many ways has the national thing, has national sewn up, but they don't have the local. If you even delve that even deeper in the high schools, you can really begin to attract an audience there. So this now the question becomes whether or not enough people are going to move into that area and be willing to actually pay that amount of money. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not they have it at the right price point to do
that.
So
let me ask you this, Mike. Can you see other areas of the paper that might work for this kind of an a la carte subscription model? Or do you think sports is unique as a potential success in this area?
Well, I mean, it's possible that content, again, that people can really use to make a difference in their work life, for example, or their daily life, business coverage, mm-hmm. maybe. But I just want to say about sports, I don't know the Miami Herald sports team. The Kansas City Stars sports coverage is really, really good.
Really good.
And so it makes sense to try this, but I have to ask a couple other questions. What's the unique value proposition of paying, what is it, $30 a year or whatever, to get just this one vertical? Now, the content's good, so we've established that. Could you get it by just visiting the website? Well, you get 10 free articles on the Star a month, and after that, unless you trick the system, that's all you can
if
get.
If you think about it, though, that's 10 free articles that could, depending on game coverage, analysis, right. and mm-hmm. columns, mm-hmm. that doesn't even get you a full month in the football season.
Right, right. But the thing that I think I wonder about is whether this will be enough, or whether there needs to be some special content that you only get if you subscribe to the sports vertical, or maybe it's ad-free or ad-limited or something, so you don't have all those annoying ads popping up all the time. We'll see what happens with initial experiment, and if it doesn't work just by offering this subscription, then maybe there could be some other features that would draw you into it.
Okay, so how it took me until this summer to catch on to this show after 11 seasons on the air is beyond me.
And as such,
I vote for Leonard!
What? I'm sorry, Sheldon. With minimal power comes minimal responsibility. And you couldn't handle it.
Don't you misquote Spider-Man to me.
It's not your fault. I mean, what man wouldn't be seduced by the power to decide how late the laundry room stays open?
Wait, you're the reason I had to come back and get my jeans the next morning?
I can't believe you expect me to give that up.
Okay, so I will admit there may be 17 or 18 episodes of The Big Bang Theory in my DVR right now. CBS announced that Season 12 is going to be its last. This has been a groundbreaking show for a lot of reasons. The longest running multi-camera show on television.
Been a fan since season one. Stepped out for a couple of seasons, but caught up real quickly.
Soft Kitty is the ringtone for my dad.
That's awesome.
I just gave that away to the world.
That's awesome. No, it's I actually, my wife, my family, we all watched the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it is groundbreaking in a sense because the awkwardness of the character. And especially Sheldon, and how that has sort of pulled people in. It's a good show.
Bazinga.
Bazinga.
Well, Mike, you have a Big Bang thought before we get more good?
Next time.
Okay. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. You can find it under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions. See previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons, and we will see you again next week for another edition of Views of the News.